This is The Conversation. It's episode 110 with Carolina Miranda of the LA Times, reporter of arts, culture, and beyond, high and low. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. Be curious to know if, through the breadth of Carolina's following, there are a few new listeners here. If so, welcome and hello. I still presume it's going to be mostly regulars, and hello to you guys. Donations are welcome. I say that up front, and I'll mention that at the back end as well, just because, you know, it takes a little prodding sometimes, and also because there have been zero donations for July. It's July 23rd as I record this, so I would love to get a few in before the end of the month. Why? To, you know, support the show in terms of the baseline costs for keeping it online and the storage and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so Carolina Miranda and I talk about everything under the sun. She covers a lot, so there's a lot to talk about. She also debuts the audio version of her shiny poem for Jeff Koons, culled from various reviews of his retrospective at the Whitney. It's good stuff. So that's towards the end. Stay tuned for that. And what else? She also talks about breaking something about Hello Kitty that you may or may not know. That was a story that went hugely viral. You will hear all about that. And what else? Before we get there, finally, I just want to say that I have been having an online exchange and have been talking about the show with people, framed in such a way that it is not as artist-centric in terms of guests as it once was. It was originally called The Conversation, an artist podcast, you know, being that I was going to talk only with artists, fuck everybody else. Now it's almost, we've almost done a reverse, 180 degrees. And that's something that we can talk about over time. It's I know many of you listening are artists. I would love to hear from you as to what you think about this. I think, to put it simply, when I talk with an artist, we can talk about everything about them. But when I talk with a writer or a curator or even a collector, as rarely as that happens, we can kind of talk about everything, you know, everything that they cover, everyone they talk to, and so on. So it's much broader, more universal, ultimately. And whereas with the artist, it tends to be very interior focused. And you know, for listeners, I think that sometimes creates a problem. I know, granted, that there are the hardcores of you out there that want to hear me talk to artists for 3 hours, but you know, I know where the drop-off point is, where it starts to get less interesting, and that's just not going to happen at this point. So unless, you know, you want to back me so I can make this a job full-time. All right. Is that TMI? Is that TMI? Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you on the back end. I really look forward to hearing what you think about this episode, and I look forward to hearing your comments and getting your messages. All right, I'll talk to you on the back end. Ciao for now. So before we talk more about your media arc, is Miranda or Miranda... Is it would you say it's generally, I don't know if this is too naive a question, but is it a name that is fairly common across countries, or it's not associated with one particular? Okay.
It's actually an Italian name, a Portuguese name, a Spanish name.
Got it.
It's like a Mediterranean.
What about Carolina?
Well, Carolina is the Spanish language Carolina, so.
Which is a very rare name, though.
I guess, but we have two states named after Carolinas, so.
It is rare now. It didn't used to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because when I was named Carolina, it was in the early 70s, and Princess Caroline of Monaco was like on the cover of all the...
So that's your namesake?
Gossip magazines. And so it ended up just being this really popular name in Latin America for a while. Like, there were a lot of women my age who were named Carolina, and then usually with a second name immediately following it. So
right.
That's how I mean, I don't think my mom didn't name me after Princess Caroline. My mom's not like that, but she just had always liked the name.
Mm-hmm.
But because Princess Caroline was sort of like doing her thing in the 70s, there, as a result, are a lot of Carolinas in South America. Like, I think that was like, you know, people used to follow her shenanigans in South America. So there are a lot of
more
Carolinas.
More than in North America?
Or maybe more than in Central. I think.
Right. Where were you born?
I was born in Wyoming.
Wow. See, you just trick people right there.
I trip people out all the time with that revelation. Yeah. I was born in the same town where Dick Cheney was raised.
Oh, God. That's got to be a source of pride.
I have a photo in front of the Dick Cheney Federal Building in Casper, Wyoming.
So that's, you were born in Casper?
I was born in Casper, Wyoming.
Wow.
My father worked in heavy construction, so we moved around a lot. And they happened to be in Casper when I came along, and so that's where I was born.
And you grew up?
And I grew up, we moved around a lot because of my father's job, but grew up mainly in Southern California, in the Valley and in Orange County, and then with stints abroad, depending on my dad's job. So
right.
A little bit of here, a little bit of there.
Where abroad?
In Saudi Arabia, Iran, and South Africa.
Wow.
Yeah. And then with long stints in South America in between to go see my family.
Oh, okay. So yeah, that's kind of, you kind of anticipated what I was wondering. So yeah. You have a lot of relatives down in South America?
Yes. I would say the vast majority of my family's in South America. My father was from Peru and my mother's from Chile. And I'd say the vast majority of the family is still down there, especially in Chile. In Peru, more of them have emigrated simply because the political situation in Peru was significantly worse in the 80s and 90s. But they are mostly down there.
And where in Chile?
Mostly in Santiago, but I also have family in Viña and Rancagua. And some family in the south. And then in Peru, my family's mainly in Lima. But then some of the Peruvian families also scattered around in Florida and Atlanta. And
right.
You know,
oh, okay.
Because I've had some family emigrate to the U.S., as well. I have a Chilean cousin here as well, but not that many.
I guess the subtext to all this is, you know, to what extent you were growing up with that culture outside of your nuclear family, right?
With South American culture or with other cultures?
Yeah, South American / Latin culture, yeah. And the language.
Yeah, I mean, definitely with the language. I didn't speak English until my parents sent me to school. Because the whole idea was that they would speak to us in Spanish as long as they possibly could, so we'd have a good formation in Spanish and be able to communicate with the family. And then once we went to school, we would learn English. And so I didn't learn to speak English until I showed up in kindergarten.
Do you remember that experience?
You know, not really. It almost seemed like no big deal, but I guess that's how you learn language when you're in, you know,
where were you when you started
old.
School?
In the Valley. In the Valley.
What part of the Valley?
What town were we? We moved so much. I always have to, I think it was in Granada Hills when we were living in Granada
Which
Hills.
Is way up north, right?
Which is, yeah, it's deep valley. And yeah, we just went to school. My sister had a tougher time with it because she was shyer, but I didn't really, you know, it's like we still heard English. English was on the television. English was around us, but my parents spoke to us in Spanish and we spoke Spanish. So
right.
For me, like, I don't remember anything specific about learning to speak English.
Yeah, that's lucky.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of amazing. No, and I'm grateful to my parents because it gave us a solid formation in another language.
Yeah.
English is certainly my principal language because it's the language I learned to read in and the language I learned to write in. The Spanish I speak is a very domestic, informal Spanish. Even though I did spend a year of university in Chile, mm-hmm. You know, my Spanish is definitely cruder than my English.
Do you ever speak Spanglish with like local LA people?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I feel everyone speaks Spanglish in LA. Like how can you live here and not know at least a few words?
Oh yeah. No. But I'm thinking more of the way that native Spanish speakers throw in, you know, the odd English word here and there.
Well, I think Spanglish works. Spanglish, interestingly, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think it works in three ways. Is you have the Spanish speaker that inserts English words. You have the English speaker that inserts Spanish words. And then increasingly, I feel like you hear people who are just kind of bouncing back and forth from one language to the
that
next.
Seems to me that's I would that feels to me the most like Spanglish because the other two are just more circumstantial. Yeah. I think the English people throwing in a word of Spanish that I you know that would depend on the case, but that sounds a little
well. It depends
fishy.
On how much Spanish they're throwing in there. So
good point. Yeah,
and the ways in which because sometimes you just run into you're speaking. I'll be speaking English with my mom. Or with a friend who speaks Spanish, and you just find a Spanish word that just far better expresses what you're trying to say than any English word could. So you throw it in there.
Yeah.
I think of it as Spanglish simply because you're working with meanings and intonation. And like by throwing a foreign language word in there, you are completely kind of shifting how you think about something. Like speaking in another language forces you to think in a different way.
Sure. As you're saying that, I'm thinking about the accents, you know, that broadcasters, you know, there was this whole movement in comedy, you know, or a lot of bad jokes, I should say, in comedy about the broadcaster who would speak the sort of broadcast English and they would throw in that word of Spanish.
Exactly.
And not just to point that out or recall that period, but when you were doing radio, is that something you were like self-conscious about?
Oh, like do I pronounce my name in Spanish or not? It's funny. The first time I did something that required, because most of the time when I first started doing radio, I was a commentator. So I was always introduced by someone else. So it wasn't an issue.
Right.
But when I started doing produced pieces, it was like I always introduced myself in English with an English pronunciation of my name. I say my name, Carolina Miranda. And so that's what I did.
As opposed to?
Carolina Andrea Miranda Silva.
Right.
My whole Spanish name.
But if you take out the middle names, it is pretty close, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I always pronounce my name in English. I did that on the radio. Every once in a while, I'd be doing stories. Like I remember once I was doing stories. I did a story about this Chicano art collective, OSCO. When they had the big retrospective at LACMA as part of Pacific Standard Time. Mm-hmm. And so I was using Spanish words as part of the piece because they use Spanish words. Because ASCO is a Spanish word that means, you know, to discuss or to have discussed. And so I'm explaining these Spanish words and I was kind of conflicted. Like, do I pronounce them in Spanish so I can sound like totally OG or do I say them in English because that's really who's listening? Like, will I sound like a blowhard? Either way, I was like, I can't really win. Like, somebody I'm sure is going to criticize me. So I figure I'm just going to pronounce them the way they feel most natural. And so whatever just sort of rolls off the tongue, that's what I'm going to do.
Right.
And so some of them would be more anglicized and some of them wouldn't, depending on the word. So I just played it instinctually. Like, if I just played it, I did it as if I would speak it to you. So
I was going to ask you about East LA, where you live. I want to come back to that, but I want to what you made me think of talking about reactions to your work made me think about, you know, looking at some of your LA Times pieces and checking out the comments, you know, and it seems though that you have, correct me if I'm wrong, you have much more of a digital platform. I mean, and obviously these pieces are online, so they're digital, but I mean, to what extent is like the tweeting that you do, and you know what I mean? Is there more conversation in a sort of real-time digital way for you than there is in the sort of, even if it's the digital version of the LA Times, it's still the LA Times?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way comments work. It's like sometimes a story of mine can get flooded with comments, and when they do, I tend not to read them because half of them will be completely insane. They can be so negative that I'm just like, I don't really need that. So I just don't even look at them.
Yeah.
But often sort of the meatier discussions about a piece will take place off of the LA Times on, say, Facebook or Twitter, where people who are interested in the subject will dialogue back and forth about it.
Right.
So while that's not to say that that hasn't happened on the LA Times page, you know, it has. I would say that the vast majority of discussion about anything I've happened to write takes place elsewhere. You know, and sometimes it's also just, you know, because the art world is so weird and sometimes people are so afraid to say what they think. You know, people will email me privately and we'll dialogue privately about it.
I think you just encapsulated this podcast. Because everybody's too afraid to say what they think.
Oh my God, they're terrified to say what they think. Like, well, what if what I think is wrong? And then Yeah. What if what I think is wrong, and then also what if what I think is controversial, unintentionally so, or what if what I think could get me off of tenure track, or, you know, there's a lot of, or what if what I think is going to alienate the big moneyed gallerist who I want to show me. Like, there's a lot of politicking that goes on in the art world. So thankfully I don't have to, like, I'm an art writer who is not an art curator or an artist herself. So I don't really, I can kind of say what I want. Nobody's going to.
Yeah. And actually, you know, that makes me think about the fact that you're kind of, I mean, would you be fair to say you're like an arts or art beat writer?
Mm-hmm. I'd say, I mean, a culture writer.
Culture writer.
Because I also do write about things other than art. The LA Times.
Right.
You know, I write about Latin music sometimes. Sure. I'll write general cultural stories as well. I write about architecture. I've written about design.
Mm-hmm.
I've written about, drug ballads in Mexico. I've written about a range of things. And when I was a freelancer, I did the same. I mean, I wrote about travel a lot and covered places like Peru and Costa Rica quite extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like... that's how I want it. It's like, I don't just want to write about art. I like having topics outside of art.
Sure.
That I write about, because I think it keeps the brain fresh and the perspective fresh and reminds you that there's a whole big world out there that doesn't really care about your abstract process art.
the abstract process artists have really been taking a hit lately. I tell you.
Well, they deserve it.
Okay, you heard it here first.
No. I mean, I'm being facetious.
Yeah,
but, you know, maybe a good spanking every once in a while.
No,
hurts anybody.
Well, actually, I was, to your point about, they don't care. I mean, one of your readers, or quote unquote readers, I should say, you really spoke to that guy because. I mean, this is the comment. I mean, I didn't read all of the comments to your pieces, but I've scrolled through some of them. And then in the Jeff Weiss piece about Prometheus, the mm-hmm. tree that was destroyed,
mm-hmm.
Not a ton of comments, if I remember right. But one guy said, this is horrible. I still don't care about art.
Yeah.
And that kind of says it all for like a huge portion of the population. I don't fucking care about your art.
Yeah.
Let's just get to the tree already.
Exactly. Let's watch TV.
Yeah.
Where's the show? No. There's people who don't care about art. Maybe there's people who don't know a lot about it. Maybe there's people who care about different kinds of vernacular art. Like they don't care about abstract process, but they might care about murals, or about sign design, or they might care about a million other things. You know, the art world is not one thing. Like, the art world is not CalArts. The art world is this very giant ecology that features
right.
all kinds of different types of, traditions of creating.
Well, yeah, and two points to that point. One is, speaking of which, the Velveteria piece mm-hmm. that you did about the Velvet Museum that this guy started. He started
in
Arizona, and now it's here,
yes.
right?
So, no, he started in Portland. He lived in Arizona, but the museum started in Portland.
Right.
He started collecting them in Arizona.
Right. Okay, so that represents another art world.
Exactly.
And is there a whole, to whatever familiarity you have, a whole community of Velvet art aficionados?
Oh, there is, and there are important Velvet artists, and I mean, I would say the infrastructure is obviously far smaller than for traditional art. There aren't huge museums and biennials and art fairs, and it's much more of an informal economy,
right.
if you will, around
right.
it. But yeah, it's a whole other universe. It's a whole other universe of people who are into these painters. Like when I went to Velveteria, I learned about all of these painters who are very important to the tradition of velvet painting throughout the 20th century. That I believe there was one artist named Edward Leetig, who is known as the father of modern day velvet painting, who was like an American who was living in the Pacific, one of the Pacific Islands, I think in Tahiti.
Mm.
And sort of helped popularize the form, and had always existed in sort of bits and pieces here and there, but he kind of helped popularize the modern day notion of it, the sort of black velvet painting with the idyllic Pacific Island scene on it, the
right.
hula girls, the grass skirts, the
right.
totems, like
right.
when you think about that kind of stuff, this is a guy who starting in the like early to mid 20th century started popularizing that kind of stuff. So you learn about this whole other world. And to me, it's just and as valid and as interesting and as compelling as anything that you might find in some highfalutin museum. You know, it's like it's people making objects that in some way represent who they are. And there's a validity to that. And so I write, my aim is to always write about those things in the same way I write about anything else, which is just with honesty and respect.
Sure. Yeah.
So
yeah, that's good.
And also it's just, that was just a fun story because, you know, there isn't all of this sort of overthinking and political machinations that go into it. Like it really, the folks who started this museum, it's a passion project. They do it because they love velvet painting and they think it's not getting any attention. It's not about political jockeying.
Right.
It's about having a real sort of passion towards something. And so when I see that as a writer, I always find that, that spark.
You know, what I also kind of hear in what you're saying, though, is the more tangible element of experiencing that kind of niche culture versus the proper art world culture is the difference between relaxed and inviting versus like a wall of intimidation,
yeah.
You know, and politics.
Well, it can
and hierarchies.
Be. I mean, you know, I'm overwhelmingly generalizing because there are people within the quote unquote art world of sort of the highbrow art world who are very inviting, who are very interesting to talk to, who are very passionate about what they do, who speak very clearly and succinctly and and articulately about what it is they do and accessibly. You know, I remember recently I did a profile of Mark Bradford on the occasion of his new solo show at the Hammer, and he's an artist who couldn't be more accessible about what he does. And so, yeah, it's not the entire art world.
No, I wasn't.
What is that?
I wasn't
what mean, is that way? But, you know, yeah. It's like, but it is interesting. But, you know, he's an artist who is still dealing with the politics of the art world, you know. And so whereas somebody like, you know, the folks at the Velvet Painting Museum, they kind of exist a little bit outside of that. And so
I think the point is that when you for people like me and probably a lot of people, most people listening who don't think much about the velvet painting world, mm-hmm. or, you know, another niche sort of art world, when they think about it or hear about, you know, your reportage on it, mm-hmm. and then you sort of go back to the art world, that to me, that's kind of the first sort of thing that I think of. I sort of draw that contrast, you know, because it's like, I think that's one difference. You could cite a lot of differences and you could talk about the art world and the nice warm people in it and all of that, but one of the MOs of the art world, and this probably might connect to some of the stuff about the market, which mm-hmm. I know you probably have a lot of interesting things to say about, is that sort of some of that machination.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, it's an industry, and people are doing what they can to get ahead in that industry, and so that might mean making a certain type of work or talking about their work in a certain way or, you know, jockeying to
people,
be in the right parties.
Or having people behind the gallery desk who are a certain way.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, there's a whole look and feel and language to it. I mean, it's its own tribe, so, you know, it's got its own mores.
Yeah. The way that I think about art worlds, because, you know, yes, there you could certainly say that there are many different art worlds.
Mm-hmm.
But when I've thought about the sort of art worlds that kind of come to mind the mm-hmm. most, there's kind of the art world, the high art world or the art world proper, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I like to refer to as the juxtapose art world, you know, mm-hmm. because that's the art world that is kind of the closest to the proper art world.
Oh,
whereas
you mean,
when you're talking about the velvet art world, you know, then you're kind of talking about something that's way off over here.
Oh, like the juxtapose art world, do you mean like in relation to Juxtapose magazine?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The kind
in other
of
words, that kind of that
pop
aesthetic.
Pop surrealism.
That, exactly.
Yeah.
That aesthetic of work, which, you know, there are many of those galleries in Culver City and
exactly.
other neighborhoods that are just adjacent.
And it gets featured in museum shows and it's
that's
like,
pretty. That's pretty rare. Because
it's rare, but it happens. I mean, I've seen exhibitions of that work at the Laguna Art Museum. There was a huge 25th anniversary of Juxtapose show there. Some of those artists individually, like Swoon recently had a giant installation at the Brooklyn Museum. You know, artists like Barry McGee have had every, you know, installation.
Well, he's a crossover artist.
He's a crossover artist, too. So the thing is, it's not like there's, it's a porous boundary. It's a porous boundary.
Okay.
So you do see some of those artists individually or collectively in museums and galleries on a pretty regular basis.
Really?
Like, not all the time, but I'd say
well,
semi-regular.
I would...
if you're looking nationally, you're going to be appearing.
I don't want to argue too fine a point on that, but, but I mean, I feel like it's pretty... I mean, like, the MoCAs and certainly the MoMAs of the world... you would be hard-pressed to find many examples of work.
Yeah.
But you go to a place like the Laguna Art Museum or smaller town museums, it's more common.
But the MoMAs of the world are also pretty slow to come to things sometimes, so you never know.
Interesting. Okay.
You never know.
Right.
And they do have work by Swoon in their permanent collection. So.
Tell me about Swoon.
Swoon is a street artist from New York. Actually, she's originally from Florida, but she's been working in New York City for a very long time. And she does these very sort of intricate, lacy, paste-up paperworks that sort of fuse figures and landscapes. She did a whole series of art boat pieces that went on journeys, like on the Mississippi, on the Hudson, at the Venice Biennale, like on the Adriatic Sea, I think it was. She's an artist whose work has resided on the street in galleries. She works on a lot of very sort of socially driven projects, community projects, projects that involve the community to make the work. And she's an artist who, you know, you'll see her work in Juxtapose, but you will see her work in MoMA's permanent collection as well.
Wow.
So she is one of the crossovers, I'd say.
Yeah, seriously. Sounds like it.
Yeah. Okay. And a woman to boot. So that's always nice.
Yeah. Well, since we were talking about before, I feel like we should kind of go back to you get to be honest, I think. I mean, I know in your piece on, remind me on the fictional character that Joe Scanlon created.
Oh, Donnell Wolford.
Donnell Wolford.
Yeah, Biennial. Yeah.
Right. So I know in your Donnell Wolford piece, you know, which is obviously one of the most controversial art sort of topics or stories of recent past, that you... if I remember right, at the end, you sort of called out the museum world to like, all right, it's your move. What is your feeling generally about being a a bullshit detector, or you know, or just or sort of fighting for parity and justice, you know, in the art world? I mean, I know you like, as you articulated, you like to mix it up, you know, and keep things fresh. But it seems that part of your work has something to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, I am interested in questions of equity in the art world and beyond. I mean, in terms of, are women being represented? Are underrepresented minorities gaining greater representation? Are we seeing the kinds of ideas? I mean, these are ideas that I care about, and I always think about the exhibitions I enjoy seeing. So it's like, are we seeing those? Can I demand that those be seen? I think we live in this moment right now where there is a lot of talk about inequity. There's a lot of talk about parity. There's a lot of talk about race. And I think to write about the art world and not think about those things at this moment in time would be a tremendous oversight. And I think it can be one of those things that makes the art world look out of touch. Like, this is happening now. And so those are important issues to me, and I have a platform where I'm allowed to discuss them. And so I discuss them, you know, like what does it mean to have a spate of shows by Black artists in Los Angeles? Is it significant? Is it not significant? Like, let's ask the question. The Donnell Wolford piece at the Whitney Biennial, there was a lot of writing on that piece. And it was really interesting because virtually none of it, except for one piece by Andrew Russeth over at Art News, he quoted the female actors involved in the work, you know, the Black female actors involved in that work. And so, you know, I was like, okay, we're having this raging debate about this very controversial work of art in which a white artist has invented this like Black fictional character that is played by a black actor. What does it mean? Like, let's talk to the actor. Why is she doing it? Why is this important? Why is this an interesting work? So if I feel like if I can ask those questions and ask them in smart ways, I will. And I feel like to not do so would be the oversight.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say then, because you quoted her essentially in your piece, what do you say to somebody like Michelle Gravner who says, you know, I'm not an accountant?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you were to take devil's advocate for a given curator who's like, let's say they see 100 artists' work,
exactly.
Right? Do they need to, you know, to what extent do they need to sort of calculate their decisions based on?
Yeah. I mean, I think to be a curator and not be thinking, and doing a group show, especially something like a biennial, which is a very sort of open concept, and not be thinking about questions of diversity, I think is a problem. I think it's problematic. And I think, yes, obviously curators are not accountant, but you know, when you see something like the Made in LA Biennial that had a very low representation of minority artists, I have to ask myself, like, why? Why are we not seeing them? And why isn't the question being asked of why they're not being represented? Is it because the art they're making doesn't necessarily appeal to whatever the trend in, you know, curatorial trend is? You know, it's not abstract process art, or it's not whatever, you know, detritus art or performance or whatever. And why are those ideas not being taken seriously in the art world?
Did you write about the...
write about that it was written about elsewhere. I had just started working at the Times when that biennial came out.
Are you talking about the first LA biennial or the second?
The second one.
Okay.
The one that recently happened.
Right.
I mean, I think there's been questions in both biennials about representation, like in a city like Los Angeles that is, you know, 50% Latino and majority minority, like why minority artists aren't represented better. So anyway, I think, yes, curators are not accountants, but to not be thinking about those issues, I think, again, these are the issues of our time. Like, how can you not be thinking about the issues
of our
time? Sure,
but just, you know, just to play devil's advocate, to, you know, how are you saying that if a given curator, such as, say, the curators of either LA Biennial,
mm-hmm.
included only X number of majority-minority artists...
Yes.
Are they therefore not thinking about that issue by exclusion, by the exclusion of those artists? Or if you were to have a conversation with them and they said, you know, yeah, I thought about it a lot. This is just the roster I wound up with. Is that possible?
It is possible. It is possible. But I don't know. LA is a pretty big city and you meet like a really wide range of artists here. And I feel like just even in the time that I've been at the LA Times, you know, I've covered work by black artists, by Asian artists, by women artists, by Latino artists, by white artists, by queer artists. So I feel like,
mm-hmm.
like if you can't find them, you're not really looking. And I feel that way as a writer. I mean, I'm a Latina and it's like, I've always heard that thing where sometimes, you know, I've worked at mainstream publications like the LA Times. I also worked at Time Magazine and editors always has sometimes had this like befuddled attitude of like, well, we can't find, you know, these writers. And I was always like, well, I'm right here. Like, are you guys not reading what I do? Like, is what I do not important? Sometimes it's what you do doesn't necessarily interest or captivate them. They can't necessarily feel passionately about the stories you do. So somehow.
So they said they couldn't find these writers like in your presence, or how did that work?
I mean, it's been this long-running debate at mainstream. I don't want to get too much into politics.
No,
of,
that's all right. I was
of
just
the
trying
places
to
I've
you.
Worked at, but it's a refrain I've heard echoed. While we would love to have more minority writers, but we just haven't found any. And the thing is, I'm like, well, that's interesting because I know a lot. So, like, why aren't they getting hired, or why aren't they getting hired here? Or it's like I'll go to some industry panel where somebody's asked that very question, and you know. And I'll be sitting in the audience and I'm like, I'm a writer, you know, like a minority writer.
That, like, sounds like a...
So it's this thing where, having sort of felt excluded in my own profession, like, I just don't entirely buy it when some curator says, well, we just couldn't find any. And I'm like, there's always some somewhere. It's like, it's just, where are you looking and what ideas are you looking for? And are these ideas just outside of your world of experience, so you don't even perhaps even know how to look for them to begin with? So...
Sounds like it's a trigger for you.
Yeah. Trigger. I mean, that sounds so deeply psychological.
But not incorrect necessarily.
No, not incorrect. I mean, I think it's something, I think this is something that every, like, minority journalist or minority artist has heard at some point.
Well, can we talk? I mean, I know you said a moment ago, I don't want to get too into it, but can we talk about your experience where you felt like you were being sort of looked over?
Yeah, I mean, what, in terms of my job or...
Yeah, in the past, when
you
were... I mean,
you know what it is? It's this, okay, it's some of the places I've worked at, and I want to keep it appropriately vague.
Sure.
I've oftentimes been the only Latina reporter at the publications I work at. Not at the LA Times, but at other places I've worked at, major national publications. I've been the only one in the room. And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, like, oh, we're doing a story. It's this double thing of like, oh, we're doing a story about Latinos, so you have to be involved because you're our only one. But then you don't really have the authority. You're not given the authority to really give your opinion and help shape things. You're kind of executing their vision. So that can be really frustrating.
Sounds condescending too.
It is condescending. It's really kind of like, yeah, oh, we're doing this special package and lucky you, you're going to get to be involved, but you really have no control over say what's going to happen.
Right.
But aren't you excited? We're featuring Latinos in this magazine. It's not really.
Yeah.
But thanks. So there's that, you know, that sort of being condescended to when they do get around to doing these types of stories. And then the other thing is the being looked over. And I've seen this, I've not just experienced this personally, but I've seen it happen to other minority reporters and other women reporters in particularly, where it's like, you know, when the editor looks around the room and thinks of the person to put on the important story, it's invariably like the white guy that, you know, women and minorities, it's like, oh, you're the black reporter, you'll get assigned to the black story, and you're the Latino reporter, we'll put you on the Latino story because you can't possibly handle this bigger story about something else. It's like, you know, white is just the default. Like, and that's the way a lot of people see our society. I think it has changed somewhat in the years that I've been in media, which is since the early 90s at this point. But it's still there. It's still that idea that you're somehow this niche property. You're not the mainstream. The mainstream is something else.
Sure.
And what I always have to say is like, no, in places like LA, I am the mainstream. So,
yeah.
So I think that should, and it should be considered as such, which is why when a curator or an editor says, oh, we can't find any writers, we can't find any artists, I'm just like, well, you're not trying hard enough.
The question that you're raising for me now is, what public or commercial institution do you think is dramatically, here or anywhere, getting it right in that regard?
Getting it right. Yeah. I think LACMA is an interesting institution in that regard. I think they've taken the representation question quite seriously. I mean, you have a Venezuelan curator, you have a Chicana curator, you have an African-American curator. And as a result, I feel like we see a range of exhibitions there that you don't get at encyclopedic museums elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have Asian art curators. Like, there's just a variety there. And I think, and on top of that, an institutional recognition that having this variety is important to the life of the institution.
Right.
So I think, I mean, there's still an institution you know, it's like turning an institution is like turning a freight ship. You know, it's like, it's
absolutely
not done quickly or easily.
Right.
But I feel as if that is one institution that has made it its mission to think about a diversity of voices in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of nationality, in terms of, you know, sexual politics, in terms of like a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they are an interesting arts institution to look at.
Mm-hmm. My sense has been that you are very LA sort of based and rooted, but that's not to say that you don't cover outside. And I just mm-hmm. wonder to what extent you've gone to the Whitney Biennial or the Venice Biennale or, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever, sort of other art world posts to, you know, try to bring something that's either in line with what you do locally or just like, this is what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do it in a international way.
Yeah. I mean, I do a combination of both. We are the LA Times, and so I am very conscientious about trying to tell the LA story. I feel like for me to be in Los Angeles and constantly write about like New York art world politics would be pointless and
sure.
and boring as hell.
Right.
But I will comment on things that I think are either really important to the art world at large, or I think represent hot button issues, or that I think would be of interest to my readers. So yes, the Whitney Biennial happened in New York. The Joe Scanlon, Donnell Wolford piece happened in New York, but it was a question of race and access and equity that people everywhere are talking about. So the fact that it was at the it was sort of went beyond the borders of the Whitney in New York, and which is why I wrote about it. And often if I'm in places, because I do a blog, I have that flexibility. It's like, okay, I'm in Massachusetts and I'm looking at the Clark. I'm here. I'll do a story about the new architecture at the Clark, mm-hmm, at Tadao mm-hmm. Ando's extension, because I've seen it and I can. So, you know, maybe my readers at home, since I was there, will be interested in something I've seen abroad. I was in Chile for a week. I did a series of architectural reports mm-hmm. on Chile, on this very interesting architecture boom that they have. And in fact, today it was announced that the next Venice Architecture Biennale director is going to be a Chilean architect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Chile's having this really interesting architectural moment. I'm in Chile. I'll cover it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of thinking about Los Angeles, of trying as best I can to cover the stories of Los Angeles for Los Angeles, but also people outside Los Angeles. But also bringing other parts of the world back to Los Angeles, you know.
To what extent do you have a sense of who your readers are?
You know, it's hard because, you know, I've only been at the LA Times a year. And
feels like forever.
I know, it feels like forever. I've only been at the LA Times for a year, and my position is a relatively new one within the scope of the Times. I'm a digital first journalist, which means that my stuff always runs first online before it runs in the paper. In fact, for the first 6 months, my stuff only ran online. And online audiences and newspaper audiences are a little different. You know, online tends to be younger and broader. The print readership tends to be a little older, a little whiter, and I believe a little bit more male, if I'm not mistaken. So they're two slightly different readerships that I'm trying to reach through this one. I mean, it's a little schizophrenic. But I get the sense that my readership in general is, you know, and I come as part of this package that is not just a cultural package. Like, the LA Times covers politics, it covers Latin America, it covers the economy. So there are people coming to the LA Times for a whole variety of reasons. So it's this readership that is at once niche and broad, because mm-hmm. I know that people within the cultural sphere follow what I do, but that I do get readers, like if there's a story that for some reason goes viral or that just catches somebody's eye, you know, I'm going to get readers from everywhere. So I have to be conscientious to write to as that when I do write, that it can't be filled with jargon, that it can't be,
right,
you know, it can't be alienating. It's got to be as widely accessible as possible.
What piece or pieces come to mind when you think of the pieces that went viral?
The pieces that went viral. Well, I did the. I'm gonna go to the grave with this. You know, it's gonna be on my gravestone. I revealed that Hello Kitty was not a cat. So that was.
What is Hello Kitty?
She's a little girl. She's a British little girl named Kitty White, but she's not a cat. So
did that break a lot of people's hearts?
Yes, somebody sent me YouTube video of little girls crying after it was revealed to them that Hello Kitty was not a cat. So I was like, get over it. There's no Santa Claus either. Like, so that was one of my big ones. Well, recently I did, I also did a story last year about an artist who had built a pool out in the Mojave Desert that, you had to, that was affiliated with the Max Center of Art and Architecture here in West Hollywood. And the way it worked is you had to go by the Art Center and get the key, the Max Center, and get the key, and then make the trip out to the Mojave Desert. And you had 24 hours in which to sort of go and return the key. And it was, and you got these GPS coordinates, and this pool was like out in the middle of nowhere, and the key opened the lock on the pool and you could get into this pool. And so the artist was doing, it was very much a piece that kind of commented on luxury goods and what people are willing to do for them, and
that's great,
and so on and so forth. Well, so that went viral.
Well, let's get into some details here. What kind of, the first picture I had was like your traditional sort of old school hotel or motel, you know, aqua blue pool with just like an ugly black, you know, waist high gate around the cement. Yeah. Is that basically what we're talking about?
It almost looked like a suitcase, you know, where it was dug into the ground. It was like a fiberglass shell that was placed into the ground. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he had it specially made or if you can buy these somewhere. And then it had a lid on it that would sort of snap shut and lock. And so
There's no gate.
There's no gate. It was just this, literally, like if you look up the photos, it's just this, this door in the middle of the desert. And then you open this door and underneath it is this pool, this little fiber. But it was very little. I mean, it was like, I think it was something like 800 gallons of water, which is, as far as pools go, it's pretty small. A pool will have, you know, upwards of 10,000 gallons of water. Or no, excuse me, 100,000 gallons of water. I looked up the stats at the time that I wrote the story because I called her because I knew that people were going to be outraged that some guy was doing a pool in the middle of the desert. But it's an 800-gallon pool. Like, really, only two people could fit in it.
So it's like a large hot tub.
It's like a large hot tub. And so I called around to some of the pools. Like, I called the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills and the Parker in Palm Springs to get a sense of, like, how much water. I just asked them to give me the dimensions of their pools, and I calculated how much. There's this online calculator you can use to figure out how many gallons of water you would need to fill that. And, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of, like, it's crazy how much water you need to fill one of those big hotel pools. So, by comparison, this artist project was literally a drop in the bucket, you know. And in a way, no less absurd than having some giant pool, like, in the middle of some Palm Springs hotel or Los Angeles hotel. Like, why is it any more ridiculous for him to put a pool out in the middle of nowhere than it is for the Parker to have three pools, you know?
So you took a dip in it, I presume, right?
I did not take a dip in it.
Why not? Isn't that the whole point?
Because you couldn't reserve the key. You had to just go to the Mac and see if the key was there. Like, the whole thing was that it was very impromptu. And then the minute you had the key, and so unfortunately with my work schedule, I didn't make it out there. I went by a couple times, but the key wasn't there. But our architecture critic made it. And so he went to
Christopher.
Yeah, Christopher Hawthorne.
So why was there such response to this piece?
Well, because I think, first of all, it was, you know, in the middle of the drought, there's this outrage about some guy building a pool in the middle of the desert. And then there's people commenting on the work itself, like, this is so ridiculous, it's so stupid, it's so vapid, why would you do such a thing? Then there was other people who thought that everyone who went to the pool would ruin the desert in the process. Then, you know, it's like everyone had something to say about it. It's funny, it's totally internet. Everyone had something to say about it, even though nobody had been to it.
See, that first point is particularly poignant to me because that is the exact bullseye of where the general public meets art, right?
Yeah. You
know, what the fuck?
Exactly.
But how did you feel? You know, I mean, obviously there's a certain amount of pride when something that you write just like skyrockets, but it goes bananas. That's your favorite expression,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it takes on a life of its own. And at some point, it's
totally
like,
takes
it's
a life so of its
own. Far beyond you.
No, and the best part, I mean, watching these stories go viral. Like, I also did one recently on this tea house in Griffith Park that a bunch of artists put in Griffith Park surreptitiously. What's really interesting is you see this, you see your story get picked up. And so somebody rewrites your story and then somebody else rewrites their story. And then by the time you read it, like a day later, it's a completely different story, but it's all still based on your story. Like, they haven't done original reporting. They've just rewritten what I wrote.
Right.
And so it's just like this bizarre echo chamber where I'm always like, where did they get that? Or they wrote it in such a way that they misread what I'd, like, they didn't read what I'd written closely enough, and so sometimes details are off. So it becomes this weird game of telephone where you just see how things are sort of echoed and echoed and echoed and echoed. And what's really amazing is how many people will completely rewrite a story without just, like, picking up the phone themselves to, like, do some reporting.
Well, you know, it's funny. Initially, I was thinking, well, isn't that kind of the epitome of the sort of the BuzzFeed culture?
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, actually,
it's everybody.
You know, right, but on the other hand, I was thinking, well, actually, from what I've been hearing, and I don't read BuzzFeed, so I'm not the best person to say or ask, but they, you know, now they have a politics department, so they're, like, getting very serious. So
I wonder. Oh yeah, they have investigative journalists. They've hired people from the LA Times.
There you go.
They've hired journalists
from
the LA Times.
So I guess there's still just this generic prevalence of, you know, second and third generation, quote unquote, reporting.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's partially the internet. That's like a million different places that take, and you know, to some degree, it's what people used to do back in the day, where you'd get the Newswire report that came in saying that there had been an accident on route whatever, and some reporter would rewrite it and it would go in the paper. It's just that the echo chamber was a lot slower.
Yeah,
you know, it would like it would take a day for the news cycle
right
to move through. Now it's like within hours you just see things like kind of metastasizing fabulous.
How long did it take for the pull piece to take off?
About a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took about a day and then it just went crazy. And then before I know it, I'm reading stories in The Guardian about it. And then, I mean, the Hello Kitty thing took about a day too. And it was kind of crazy because that story went really crazy. I mean, that went crazier than anything I've ever written in my life. And I was getting crazy tweets and emails from people and hate mail, like, how dare you, like, destroy my childhood. And then one guy took the trouble to, like, read my bio, and he was like, you went to Smith to write these kinds of dumb stories, like, what's your problem? And I'm just like, you know, here's my blog, feel free to read my 2500 word essay on art and race at the Whitney Biennial before you make that accusation. I would literally do that. I got so fed up. I'm just like, here's my, you know, 2,500 word essay on race. Go at it. And then we can talk. And I would never hear from them again. So I'd get crazy mail. And then it was just going crazy in the news. Like, the news people were covering it. And it was getting picked up on blogs. And it was getting picked up by, like, companies who were making jokes about it. And Katy Perry was tweeting about it. And then the next thing I know, there's, like, a New Yorker cartoon about it. So...
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
We're going to have to use that for your post. yeah. So it sounds like I want to say, okay, there's got to be some kind of benefit to getting that kind of traction. But then as I'm hearing you describe it, it kind of sounds like, oh, this isn't worth it.
You know what? It's not that it's, I wouldn't say it's not worth it. I mean, stuff hits that stuff hits. The way I look at it is sometimes stuff is going to go viral, and the thing is you just have no control over it. It's not yours anymore. I mean, I think that's the most important to think about it. It's not like Carolina Miranda's going viral. It's just a story I happen to tell that's going viral. And so in a weird way, I don't take it personally either way. Like, it's not really about me.
Right.
It's not about me. It's about something else. I don't own it. You know, it's just something I relayed, and it gets relayed and relayed and relayed again. And it's kind of funny and weird and strange to watch, because something that you first kind of articulated is now part of the popular culture. So that is strange. So I wouldn't say it's not worth it. It's just kind of a strange disembodied experience. But it's also, I think for me, a lesson of, like, I don't write in order to have things go viral. Like, it doesn't motivate what I do. What I do is motivated by trying to just report interesting stories and find interesting people to talk to.
Right.
And, you know, in the case of Hello Kitty, it was like the last week of August. There were several Hello Kitty things coming down the pipe in Los Angeles. And I'm always interested in popular culture. And I was like, well, let me just do a little item about this. I'll talk to the curator, get some quotes.
Right.
And it was the curator who told me, they're like, no, Sanrio says she's not a cat. You know, she's a little girl and we're not allowed to refer to her as a cat. And I was like, really? Are you sure? Like, I kept asking her the question because I was like, are you sure? Like, if I'm going to print this, I want to make sure. I looked around, like, nobody had ever said this before. I was like, you're positive. She's like, I'm positive. Like,
well, okay. So see, now you're making me realize that, I didn't mean to say that, that you're, one of your biggest goals was to, like, go as viral as possible.
I didn't take it that way. I just see it as, like, you know, it kind of happens sometimes. And
right.
you know, I thought with a Hello Kitty that it would get some online. I figured it would get some online, like people going, "No, this is crazy. Of course she's a cat." I didn't expect it to be like on the news and like New Yorker cartoons and
that's awesome.
Katy Perry tweeting about it, you know.
But see, what you did say in your describing your conversation with the curator,
yeah,
that, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? That what that brings up is you're breaking something. And that, I would think, even when you're sort of working generally in this more middle ground, you know, I want to expose this place or this person.
Yeah.
That's the satisfaction. But it's got to be satisfying when you really break something.
Yeah.
However small.
Yeah. However, I mean, it's just, it's fun and it is kind of weirdly rewarding. And it gets a lot of traffic, so I know the LA Times is happy.
Get to keep your job
you know,
another day.
Well, I see it as the kind of thing, like, I write a Hello Kitty story and it goes crazy, and then I can write a story about prison photography that, you know, 50 people will read, and it's going to be okay because it all evens out in the end.
Right, right. So there's a tracking device for the website for every piece, for every story, right?
Yeah, yeah, they keep tabs of every story.
So have you had as few as 50 then?
I don't know. I don't. You know what? Actually, they don't tell me my traffic, and I've never asked for it. And I've done that on purpose because I don't ever want to think that I'm writing stories for the purpose of trying to get clicks. Like, as a reader, I'm totally over clickbait, and I find it irritating and kind of dumb after a while. So I almost don't want to know my traffic because then I... You know, obviously I have a sense of the stories that have gotten a ton of traffic, but I don't want that to be the guiding principle of why I write things.
Sure.
So I'm almost like, you know, back in the day, journalists didn't know what the circulation of the newspaper was or how many copies a particular issue had sold. And I think that's kind of a nice way to operate. I operate more on instinct. What's an interesting story? An interesting story? And then in between those interesting stories, I end up finding stuff that goes viral.
Right, right. It's interesting to me, being this sort of medium or, you know, reporter, whatever word you want to use, the sort of the dynamic of it. I mean, because you can be... I mean, it sounds... the sense that I'm getting from you is that you're sort of happy to be excited about exposing, you know, sort of niche and sort of undercovered areas, but maybe with more popular things, because this is how I feel like if I have a conversation with a certain type of person, you might feel kind of like you're servicing them a little bit. You know what I mean?
Like, well, and that's why, I mean, I think, and that all boils down to the reporting. Like, I always, you know, I always say I'm not here to rewrite press releases. And so, for example, as goofy as the Hello Kitty story was, you know, I ended up, if you go back and read the original, the story became Hello Kitty's Not a Cat. But if you read my original story, I had like, I forget if it was 3 to 5 things like that you didn't know how about Hello Kitty. But I ended up having this really interesting conversation with the curator about how she became this icon to young Asian American women in the United States in the 1970s and 80s because it was this idea of something from Asian culture that was positive and, you know, it was theirs. It was like this kind of like, here's something cool that can be ours. We're not just the images of war in Vietnam or, you know, immigrant bashing or, you know, Pearl Harbor. Like, you think of all sort of like the negative images that our society might have of Asians. Like, here was something about Japanese culture that was cool. And so it was a really interesting, I found that a really interesting conversation to have. Like, yeah, let's talk about how this, you know, merchy pop culture item represented something else to a lot of people when she first emerged. And so I think that, yes, I'm always very conscientious of, like, I'm not here to rewrite press releases, but I think in any story, there's always the story behind the story, and that those stories can be really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and reveal something about our greater culture.
So we're recording in our friend John Kincaid's house, which we're really grateful for. And he was asking before we started how your stories come to you. And I mean, with this volume coming down the pipe all the time, that's got to be pretty hard sometimes, right?
Well, I mean, I feel like there are always more stories I want to write than I get to write.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I feel
so
like...
So you have a queue?
Yeah, I usually have a queue. I'm usually running at least a week behind on it, too. You know, I get my stories from like a whole bunch of different places. It might be a publicist pitching me. It might be a conversation I had with an artist. And, you know, the thing I always ask artists is like, you know, what do you have coming down the pipe? Tell me what you're working on.
Got it.
And so sometimes I'll hear about really interesting things that way. Sometimes it'll be a press release for a show, like an artist I'm just interested in comes to town. And so I'll jump on it and maybe do a Q&A or a related piece. Sometimes a friend will tell me something like, have you heard about X? And then occasionally I'll get assigned a story. So it's through a combination of routes that I get stories, but I always feel like LA has so many stories. It's so big. And, you know, this isn't like New York, which is capital of media, where you have like all these art magazines and all these websites and all these newspapers and all these general interest magazines, and they're all there and they're all covering it all the time. Like the media landscape here is much smaller and the city's much bigger and more diffuse. So I feel like if there's too much to cover, like we need more reporters like writing stories here.
Right, right. Well, let's just take a few examples. Uh-huh. And I want to use ones that are that not particularly, you know, or not at all art world centric. So there's Velveteria, there's Jeff Weiss, there's.
I mean, there's the.
Well, you can give us one example.
I do Latin music stuff. I did. I reviewed the Latin Grammys, the last Latin Grammys for the LA Times. That was like a lot of fun.
Was it? You went?
Oh yeah, I didn't go. I watched it on TV and just sort of did a critical piece on sort of what, and it ended up being really interesting because the Latin Grammys telecast was actually delayed to because Obama was making an immigration policy announcement. And so what you had was you had all of these like dolled up Latin music stars in the, you know, at, were they in Miami or were they at the Staples Center? I forget where they were, but they, you know, they're all in this auditorium waiting for the awards to start, and Univision delays broadcast of the awards because of this important Obama policy speech. And so they're all in this auditorium in their sequins and their big hair and their makeup watching this Obama policy speech on the screen. And it was this really interesting moment because it was like, well, here's something that would never happen on the regular Grammys. It's like, first of all, the idea that the regular Grammys would be interrupted for a policy speech, much less a speech about immigration, it would just never happen. It would just never happen. But here was an issue that was of such burning interest to a particular community that they were like, okay, we're going to push this back. And you have all of these like celebrities like watching
got it.
Like Obama's policy speech. So it ended up being this like really interesting moment.
Politics and pop music colliding.
Politics and pop music kind of colliding in this interesting way. And then the first act up was Calle 13, which is this Puerto Rican sort of hip hop. They do a lot of hip hop. They do other stuff too, duo. And they're very political. And so it was just this really interesting juxtaposition of Obama's policy speech talking about immigration and deportation and all of these things. And then, you know, trying to get like an immigration bill passed.
Right, right.
Followed by this very political song by Calle 13.
Right, right,
so
right.
It's just like, well, here's something that would never happen on the regular.
Right,
Grammys.
Right, right. Like,
so, yeah, I do a wide range of stuff.
I mean, I wonder if it's great that you have so many options, you know, and then it's, I mean, compared to some reporters who are probably like, I don't have any ideas, you know what I mean? But I wonder too, you know, if you're writing about everything from something that comes from a press release to, you know, oh, cover, you know, the Latin Grammys, if it's like, gets to be a little overwhelming at times.
It can be a little, shifting gears can be a little tough sometimes because there will literally be, there was this one week recently where I forget who it was. Oh, I was, you know, I'm interviewing an artist 1 second and then a Mexican rock band the next and, you know, doing a little Q&A after that. And it's just, sometimes it'll be like, okay, wait, who am I talking to? What are we talking about? And having to shift the gears and the speed with which you have to do it because I'm digital first. So the idea is to kind of print as much as possible online to publish as much as possible. So it can be a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do feel like, I guess like the way rock bands on tour feel where you're just kind of like, okay, where am I? What city is it? What day of the week is it? I have no idea what's going on. Except like a rock star, except without the money or the drugs, you know.
Do you have a shutdown period?
Yeah, I've been trying. Initially, when I first got hired, I was working like 7 days a week. But now I've been trying to be really good about just keeping the weekends for myself. And it's difficult because a lot of openings are held on weekends. But it just means I have to miss stuff. Like, I just can't. I can't be everywhere all the time. It's impossible. And
do you find going to openings helpful for your reporting?
Not generally, no. I generally find them pretty tedious, and you can't look at the art anyway. So what I usually try to do is, if I've got a few hours on a weekday, I'll go look at galleries then, usually Friday afternoons, because then I can sort of cruise in and out really fast, spend time at places I want to spend time at, not get stuck in like glad handing. And then, or maybe Saturday morning. Saturday mornings can also sometimes be like, okay, I'll go see a few spaces, you know, eat some ice cream, hang it, you know, just keep it kind of easy.
Will you ever go be one of the press attendees to a press opening event?
Yeah, I sometimes go to those at the museums. At the museums, sometimes those can be helpful because, especially if you have something like, for example, if there's some show of Renaissance painting at the Getty, which is a subject I don't know very much about, they might have the curator there doing a walkthrough that'll explain things, and I find that really helpful.
Right, right.
Because you can learn a lot about why a show was put together the way it was put together. I don't do them all the time because sometimes I'm just on deadline for something else and I just can't make it to the opening. But gallery openings I tend not to go to because there's too many of them, and then, you know, you get...
There's no point for you.
Yeah, and then you get stuck doing all the talking, and you can't see the work. And for me, it's kind of like I need to... And granted, it's important for me to go to them sometimes because I do one of the sources of stories is talking to people. And so, you know, it'll be...
So what story that you can remember most recently did an artist give you?
Did an artist give me? I mean, the Griffith Park Tea House story was something that, you know, the artist reached out, and they're like... I had heard about it sideways from a friend of a friend, and then, you know, and then they reached out, and then we talked about whether, you know, how and whether I would cover it. And
what is it for people who haven't heard?
That
of it?
Was it was a group of anonymous artists who installed a tea house in Griffith Park here in Los Angeles surreptitiously. You know, they went in the middle of the night and kind of had this tea house built. There was an abandoned foundation.
Got
on
it.
On one of the hillsides, and so that had previously held, I think, so it was a Department of Water and Power infrastructure, and so it was just this abandoned foundation with some rebar poking out of it, and they decided, like, wouldn't it be nice to put something here that people could actually hang out in rather than this ugly, and it's actually at this point with like incredible views to the east of the San Gabriels. And so they went in the middle of the night and put this tea house and then held like a little ceremony for it in the morning. So I attended the ceremony. So that was one where I heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
There are other, like the USC stuff I've been doing about the USC MFA.
What's the latest on that for people who are following that story?
The latest on it is that the students from the class of 2015, which means the students who just graduated, not the ones who withdrew, but the second years that just graduated, wrote a protest letter to the school asking that the dean resign, that Dean Eric Mull resign, that they felt like the quality of the program had sort of gone down precipitously in their time at the school. And I think they hadn't spoken out earlier because they were just trying to wrap things up as a class and get their degrees, you know?
Right.
But they just issued a letter about that.
But this was the second year students where it was the first year.
It was the first years that withdrew.
Withdrew.
The first years withdrew.
And what are they doing?
They're withdrawn now. And in fact, they now have a show at Parkview Gallery in the Westlake MacArthur Park area. It's a small gallery run by Paul Soto. And so he had been talking to them. And what had happened when they left the university, it's like, you know, they lost their studio spaces. They lost all of sort of the benefits of being MFA students at USC. So they, so Paul said, you know, it's summer, like, let's do a show of the work here. Like, let's bring everybody back together. And so they have a show. I've not made it over there to see it yet, but they have a show at Parkview right now. And Paul, who, you know, Paul used to work at Suzanne Vellmetter. He has shown some really sophisticated work at Parkview.
Oh, I think I've met him.
Yeah, he said he was very impressed with the students and sort of the intelligence they had and the way in which it's a very small space, the ways in which they approached it and were sort of very sensitive to the way the space worked in terms of installation. He just decided to be like hands off and let them go. And he said that it worked out really well. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. So anyway, that was, I had been sort of kept apprised at the situation at USC by artists who were sort of, you know, guest lecturing there and doing other things there. You know, people kind of giving me the heads up that the,
right,
that the program was in trouble. And people were leaving, and you know, I'd heard about Francis Stark leaving, and but when the students withdrew, that's really when it became news, because you know, I'm also writing for the general LA public, you know, not necessarily an art world audience, so I sort of have to pick the stories that I know will be most relevant to that audience.
Do you have a sense, though, in the wake of all this, that the school is struggling?
Well, or I mean, they only have one student enrolled for next year.
Wow.
And it's a student who gets a full ride. So
that's impressive.
From abroad. It's an international student from abroad who gets a full ride. And that's the only student who's enrolled, because I think there's been such tumult that nobody wants to go there. I mean, I think, you know, people go to art school to work with certain artists and be with certain people. And so I think with everything being so in flux,
people looked elsewhere.
People looked elsewhere. And so there's only one student for next year. You know, can the program bounce back at this point? I have no idea. I have no idea. I know that somebody told me the other day that apparently there was a point in the 90s where that program only had one student. You know, that it's gone back and forth in terms of... But it really, it was like in the last... I don't know. I think in the last decade where that program really started to pick up steam. And then now it's... The brakes have been put on.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Well, this is an abrupt change in topic, but do you read have you read poetry at all? Do you like to read poetry? I mean, I should say, like, for an audience or out loud, if you will.
I've never read poetry.
Would you like to start now?
I could read poetry. What do you want me to read? That was one of those cases where it was like, you know, talking about being in LA and covering larger art world stories. It was one of those things where when that show opened at the Whitney, when the Jeff Koons show opened, I mean, the art world just went bananas. I kept seeing it written about everywhere, like blog posts, tweets, Facebook updates, critical reviews, another critical review, and all of this, like, completely, the language on it was so intense, because I think Koons induces such an intense reaction in people, either of joy or hatred. And so the language was just so colorful that I saw coming out of it. And I had been thinking, kind of like, okay, here's this thing that everybody's talking about. Is there a way for me to tackle it? And I was like, well, without seeing the show, there's really not much I can say or add. But then in reading all of these reviews, I was like, maybe in just compiling all of this review language into like this crazy work of cut up poetry, I'll get at what this is about.
Exactly. Yeah. And at first I misread your intro to it, that you thought there was just a ridiculous amount of praise for the show. But then I realized that as I kept reading that you were praising just the writing itself.
The histrionic nature of the language. I mean, exactly. It was the language that really caught my eye on all of it. Because, you know, it's like a lot of art reviews, they're not necessarily all that interesting when it comes to the ways in which writers use language. But the Jeff Koons reviews, I mean, plus it's like you have all of these giant, shiny works and things about sex and, you know, the Koons character himself.
Right.
Who just induces such passionate reactions in people.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like, I have to do something with this. And at first I thought, oh, maybe I'll just put excerpts of the most interesting reviews. But then I thought, no, that'd be kind of wasted. Like, everyone's already read these. And as I was sort of cutting the most interesting pieces, I was realizing that the language just had this like intensity and kind of, I don't know, almost movement to it that was just too interesting to not.
So do you
play
have a,
with.
Do you have a title for it?
I think it's my cut up poem to Jeff Koons.
Yeah,
I don't know
I think
if
that's
I
it.
Titled it.
Yeah, I think that's it. So here's Carolina Miranda reading her cut up poem to Jeff Koons.
Jeff Koons has won. the reigning artist king, its proud court jester, the poster child for art world excess, a bland Mitt Romney Teletubby, a mysterious force of nature, the perma-smiling master of high art and low, as freakish as Andy Warhol, complicated, bizarre, thrilling, alien, benevolent, terrifying, goofy, always immaculate. Is his factory of art makers really that different from BuzzFeed? Gleaming in the ghost light of fluorescent tubes, shiny new Hoovers in pristine sealed acrylic cases, anthropomorphized and fetishized, odes to domesticity, hygiene and American assembly lines, rendering consumerism into something deeply libidinous, hyper-anal retentive pop collages peppered with cartoon creatures and vulvas, miraculous constructions in which basketballs float in minutely calibrated salt water, shellacked paintings of flying sandwiches and grinning monkeys, paint, dessert, and psychedelic poop, something fantastic, something disastrous. They don't even revile. They merely recede. Silliness, shininess, filled with flops, with wax chest and having anal sex, buoyant devices that will sink you, a creepy fecundity suggestive of erupting skin, simmering mud or sewage, a pietà-inspired homage to the king of pop and his favorite monkey, a ridiculous marble sculpture depicting a bejeweled and bare-chested staller, the perfect Kardashian wedding centerpiece. Jeff Koons poses next to a pig grinning. Jeff Koons wears a luxurious bathrobe. Jeff Koons is served cake by half-naked women. Jeff Koons stands in front of a room full of children, spelling out the word banality on a chalkboard. His mystifying persona is perhaps his most enduring artwork. He irritates most when he insists he has no desire to irritate. Only a cynic could see cynicism in this cosmically, freakishly sincere true believer. He loves childhood and sex. He wants to be your Norman Rockwell, your life coach, and your gym buddy. The hype has been endless for this. The oligarchical collectors of our age, we know, do not care. They like their art instantly recognizable, easily graspable, unchallenging, and shiny. Little more than a Gagosian showroom, high production art that sells like crystal meth. The ready-made crossed with greed, money, creepy beauty, and the ugliness of our culture, reeking of Gilded Age excess, art star hubris, the ever-widening inequality gap. Thoughts, however unformed, about who culture is aimed at and how desire is constructed. That ball is made for you. Look in it, and you see yourself. Join the idolaters and take another selfie in the distorted reflection of Koons' mirrored objects. There is a funereal air about this exhibition. The god Hercules, a Belvedere torso, and a pimped-out mailbox, each with a single blue gazing ball, an amorous pink panther, a pig flanked by angels, a London bobby befriending a goofy bear. Bubbles still affronts and generates an agreeable queasiness. There's something truly cruel in his sculpture's indifference to any audience desire for profundity. Koons himself smiling too broadly to see the culture he propitiates collapse around him. Pity his army of studio assistants. You're a killer of art. You're a killer of beauty. You're even a killer of laughter. His universal shtick is an illusion. The most potent and inventive artist of this mad, frothy era, that era will come to an end.
Bravo. Now, as I was listening to that, I was wondering, do you think this is a precedent for art criticism cut poetry? It has to be, right?
I think there's a lot of, it's interesting. You've seen critics do lots of things. Critics have written letters. Critics have done sort of novelistic takes. I once saw on Hyperallergic some writers that did a piece of criticism as a comic book. And so I think, why not, right? Although this was less about criticizing Koons' show than it was about just like, let's just play with this language that is just being thrown around right now.
Right.
But I think the way it was structured, I think it was very much, a criticism of Koons.
I feel like it needs to have another life because somehow, somewhere else, because it's not a story. So people aren't like,
exactly.
It's not circulating that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, it did get quite a bit of traction when it first came out.
It did.
Like I saw it get passed around and it made the rounds on social media and like some websites picked it up. But it was one of those things that it's probably bizarrely one of the things I'm probably proudest of, because I think at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, I write about art, but really what I am is a writer and a storyteller. Like, that's really what I do. I think the subjects I cover are almost secondary to that in terms of how I regard myself. And so to be able to, I think, play with language in a way that might surprise and delight people, that's what I want to do.
Well, you did say at the end of the day, but you never said practice, so you get big kudos for that.
I'm thinking outside the box.
Thank you so much, Caroline. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me. And thank you for letting me read that poem. It was really fun.
Good.
I'm glad it's going to exist on audio.
It is. It totally is. And we're out.
There you have it. What did you think of that shiny poem for Jeff Koons? Pretty good stuff, huh? Where else are you going to hear Carolina Miranda read a shiny poem for Jeff Koons? You're not going to hear it on fucking NPR. You're not going to hear it on the LA Times. You got to come to the podcast. You got to come to this podcast. Sorry, Carolina. That's how we do it in podcast world. Thank you so much for being here. The website again for the show is theconversationpod.com. Again, to remind you, no donations yet for July. Got to keep that, the web hosting going. So your support, this is a listener-supported show. Your support is very much appreciated. What else? Want to let you know that there is a live event of the conversation being planned for early September. I will keep you posted on that, but mark your calendars. I believe it's the 9th. Hopefully it will happen. Keep that in mind. I will fill you in more as we get a little closer. Again, you can support the show other ways as well, or in addition to donating by following on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, becoming a fan on Facebook. You can also go to the iTunes page for the show where you can leave a nice review and a good rating. And if you subscribe as well, these are all ways that apparently help traffic, let more people find this show so we can broaden the base, which is crucial for survival and prospering. Thank you so much again for being here. I really appreciate it. I really, really love getting your personal emails and even letters. Only happened once, but maybe it'll happen again at some point. Telling me what you think of the show, what you like about it, what you like in particular, and that you enjoy listening. So thank you so much one more time, and I will talk to you soon.